Funding for the connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Long before he came to lead the anti-Vietnam War forces to the Democratic presidential nomination in 1972, our guest George McGovern was a food man. He grew up in a minister's family that took phrases like, feed my lambs, or I was hungry and you fed me, to heart. And then he came to Congress to represent South Dakota farmers who had an abundance of grain to sell. When George McGovern was running Food for Peace for President Kennedy in the early 1960s, Pope John XXIII took his hands and said, when your maker asks, have you fed the hungry, you may answer, yes. And yet 40 years later, the problem is not solved, and some would say it's gotten worse. A huge growth of the Earth's population has been more than met by a still huger growth of food production, and still farmers are the poorest people in the world, and 800 million people on the planet are certified as hungry. An inescapable question here is whether the bounteous green revolution and modern farming that's so chemical and capital-intensive are actually making poor farmers poorer. Connection listeners, we're hearing George McGovern's five-point plan to end hunger in our time, and we're putting it to the test this hour. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Is genetic modification part of the problem or part of the solution? And what is the American model of family farming or corporate farming that we want to export? Make the McGovern connection at 1-800-423-TALK. And welcome back, George McGovern. Senator, I want to ask just in a general way, for starters, what is the wisdom that Americans have to export on this question, wisdom along with our magnificent agricultural produce?
Well, the wisdom is the knowledge of American farmers as to how you can run a family farm and how you can carry on farming so that you make the most efficient possible use of your land, your water, and of other ingredients that go into production of crops. I've just come in the last couple of weeks from a visit to Russia where I saw agriculture that's not very well run. The machinery's not very good. The land is not farmed as well as it should be. And as a consequence, even though 50% of the Russians are still in agriculture, they can't feed the other 50% of the Russian people. Here in the United States, our family farms and some corporate farms feed the entire nation with only 3% of our people involved in agriculture. We need to share some of that knowledge with countries that aren't so fortunate.
And yet, as you well know, there are so many ironies and tragedies in that American farm experience. I mean, millions and millions of family farmers have been driven off the land by not just corporate farmers, but by the new, very expensive technology and chemical management. It's been a losing battle for an awful lot of American farmers, and a whole lot of American farmers are still poor.
Well, agriculture in the United States mirrors what's been happening to small business. As we have been able to produce more productively in larger industrial units, many small businesses have gone by the wayside, as well as smaller farms. I always thought when I was a member of the Congress that we ought to gear our farm price support system primarily to family-sized farms. I've never really believed in subsidizing large corporate-sized farms. They can get by without price support subsidies. But nonetheless, you take the system as it is and make the most of it. The biggest problem we have right now with American agriculture is that it's so productive that we're producing more than the market will absorb. And what I have suggested is that we ought to utilize that surplus in a constructive way to meet the needs of people who aren't in the commercial market. For example, hungry children around the world. You don't find little kids lined up at the Chicago Board of Trade buying sow belly futures or dealing with soybean futures. These people are not in commercial markets. They're just hungry because they don't have the money to buy a nutritious diet.
I want you to go back to the family farmer for a moment. I had the joy of covering your presidential campaign an awfully long time ago, and in those days, I remember you used to say to me, we'll never lose the family farmer in America because it takes a family to make a farm work. But an awful lot of families have been driven off the land or driven into poverty in those past 30 years. What's the risk in exporting our methods and our technology that will drive a whole lot of third world farmers into poverty and off the land?
Well, let me put it to you this way, Chris. We have done a lot of that over the last 50 years. We have indeed exported our knowledge of agriculture. When I was running the Food for Peace program back in the early 1960s, the number one problem was India. They had almost 1 billion people, and most of them were hungry. Now, thanks to scientific farming, what is sometimes loosely called the Green Revolution, India today produces enough to feed most of their people, and they even export some grains. That's the result of scientific farming, the better use of water, the better use of land, the use of fertilizer, some genetically modified crops. All of those things have contributed to a situation where India is a much happier place today than it was 50 years ago, and we need to do that kind of thing in other parts of the world. I know that some people are afraid of scientific farming. People have always been afraid of science. The first time somebody announced the world was round, he was scoffed at as a fool. And that every scientific breakthrough produces that initial reaction. The same thing with scientific agriculture. But the blessings of science as applied to agriculture greatly outweigh the risks.
Let's talk about genetic modification. Are you for it?
I'm absolutely for it, obviously with some caution. The United States does most of the genetically modified crops. As a matter of fact, three-fourths of all the genetically grown crops in the world are grown here in the United States, and that is natural in view of the land-grant colleges, the agricultural experiment stations, the work of great scientists such as Norman Borlaug, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who did so much on the Green Revolution. But let me just cite you one example of why I'm for exploring the possibilities of genetically modified crops. I think you know that of the 6 billion people that live on this planet, more than a third of them, actually 2.5 billion of them, live almost exclusively on rice. They eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner if they have three meals a day. The problem with this traditional white rice, unmodified white rice, is that it's low in certain crucial nutrients, low on vitamin A, low on iron, low on other nutrients. And as a consequence, millions, tens of millions of people that survive on rice almost exclusively go blind, especially children. Others die prematurely. Now, two great scientists, one in Switzerland and one in Germany, who appeared on the cover of Time magazine a couple of months ago, have discovered through genetic modification how to produce what they call golden rice, because it's yellow. It's called golden rice. It has enough vitamin A, it has enough iron, it has enough nutrients, so that the people, by actual tests, are healthier than they are on the traditional white rice. There's some suspicion of it about it because it's yellow. But it's and that you have to overcome those suspicions. But in the long run, it'll be a great improvement in the diets of people.
We're talking about hunger and food production. Population up, food production up even more, and yet hunger still an enormous problem in the world for at least 800 million certified hungry. How's to bring all of those curves together? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with former senator from South Dakota, George McGovern, who is now the United States ambassador to the UN food agencies in Rome. 1-800-423-TALK. Amy is on the line. Amy, are you there? Welcome, Amy.
I'm extremely actually troubled by some of the conclusions of Mr. McGovern. Vandana Shiva is I'm a scientist, but she's also a scientist from India, has done a massive expose of the impact of the Green Revolution in India, and has a book published in India called The Violence of the Green Revolution, talking about how the debt incursion from that project, the impact that monocropping had on soil desertification, topsoil loss, soil flooding in certain regions. And maybe today 80% of the diet is rice, but 40% was rice before the Green Revolution, before monocropping, before this idea of chemical production that and then to say, as far as like solving this problem with the genetic engineering, which again hasn't, you know, been tested, that I know you've done a show on that before, and that was a great show, and there's a lot of questions out there about the impact of using genetic engineering.
Amy, I take the general point, and I'm sure the senator does. I mean, Senator, these are things you've worried about in an American context too: loss of topsoil, loss of the long view, loss of a kind of social balance in the farm states. How do you feel about it in the world here?
Well, it's a very serious problem. I don't want to argue that we have resolved all the problems of food supply and land management and water usage because we know something about gene modification. That's not the answer alone to our problems, but it's a supplementary tool that we ought to use intelligently, and not back off from because it has the word science in it. That's what I'm suggesting. You know, you talk about the fact that we still have hunger in the world, and of course we do. But when I ran for president in 1972, 35% of the world's people were hungry every day of their lives. Today, that percentage has fallen to 17%. Now, that's still too many. That still means that we've got 800 million hungry people on this planet. But it's a big improvement over where we were 30 years ago.
Amy, if science isn't the whole answer, what's your plan in sort of agricultural land use planning and ownership?
Well, I think science can be done in many different ways, and I am a scientist. One through the kind of paradigm of controlling and dominating nature, and another through working in harmony like the organic farmers in the U.S. are trying to do, to learn more about nature's own processes and make them work better for sustainable long-term yields. You know, right now we have great agricultural yields in the U.S. What's going to happen as the topsoil erosion continues, as pesticides continue to get stronger? So,
Amy, I take your point, and it's a good one. We're talking about hunger and farm policy with former Senator George McGovern. His book is called The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about farm policy and hunger with former Senator George McGovern, who wants to end hunger in our time. I love the line in the book that President Kennedy had said to you he didn't want to hear about farm policy from anybody but John Kenneth Galbraith, and he didn't want to hear it from Galbraith either. It's a tough nest of issues, but let's have at it. 1-800-423-8255 makes the farming and the hunger connection. Peter Rossett is on the line, co-director of Food First, a student of both the science and the economics of farm policy. Peter Rossett, you heard George McGovern's brief for a sort of in favor of scientific farming. What's your answer?
Well, the first thing that I'd like to say is that the senator is one of my all-time heroes in my lifetime.
And mine too.
I can't say what a great honor it is for me to be on this show. When I was 17 years old, I was a volunteer in his presidential campaign, not just because of his stand against the war in Vietnam, which was courageous, but because of his visionary proposal to provide every American with a guaranteed minimum income. And let me say that had George McGovern won that election, as he indeed should have, the problems of homelessness and soup kitchens and hunger in this country that are so severe now really wouldn't be with us. So to me, it's just an unbelievable pleasure to have this opportunity. And I think it's very important that the senator has written this book, The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time, because it brings the hunger issue back to the forefront of debate about public policy in this country and the world, takes us a little bit away from this economic efficiency crap of the Republicans, puts right and wrong and the moral imperative back into the discussion.
Hubert Humphrey used to love to say, that word efficiency, I can't find it in the Bible. It's just not there.
Right, exactly. So I want to say that I'm very happy that the senator has done this, that he's speaking out about hunger once again, as he has so many times.
But don't be shy about spelling out your differences, too.
Okay, and of course we have differences. No one's going to agree on such a complex issue. Probably half the book I agree with completely, and it follows very closely the arguments in my book, World Hunger, 12 Myths. There are some points where we disagree: genetically modified crops, the importance of food aid. Maybe we could quibble a little bit on trade policy, but I think from the moral point of view, we're coming from exactly the same position. And it's good to get this debate started. That people who do believe that ending hunger is a moral imperative, okay, then we can talk about what are the different approaches.
But is high-tech farming the answer?
Well, in my opinion, and I have a PhD in biology, I certainly embrace science as our previous caller Amy does, but I tend to agree more with the senator's grandchildren on the issue of genetic engineering of crops. I find it to be an enormous distraction from the real work that we have to do to end hunger. It's diverting an incredible proportion of our research resources. I happen to think that there are other scientific approaches to agricultural production that offer much more potential. I feel that the risks haven't been seriously evaluated. I wouldn't say let's stop research on genetic engineering, but I would say let's not use these things in the field unless we can agree as reasonable people on a series of tests for environmental and human health safety that ought to be performed on any product before it's approved. Because the sad truth is that neither USDA nor FDA nor the EPA has mandated not one single required test for human health, safety, or for the environment, and something that really is a concern, not to be dismissed lightly.
How do you debt hunger, Peter Russet?
Well, in our research at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, Food First, over 25 years, has led us, I believe, to probably the same agreement that the senator has, which is that poverty and inequality are absolutely the underlying causes of hunger. And we only have to look at our country, as the senator does in the book, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, where surplus agricultural production and food production is the rule, to see that the number of hungry people, according to the USDA, just since welfare reform passed, rose from 30 million Americans to 36 million Americans. That's a huge increase, but it highlights something we found around the world. It's policy and human decisions that cause hunger. It's not a shortage of food.
Senator McGovern, you say the same thing in different languages, that hunger is a political issue. It's not a food production issue.
That's the opening line of my book. Hunger is a political condition. I appreciate the very kind words from the caller, and I have read his work to my profit, and he's done a wonderful job, he and his colleagues, of educating many of us on the problems of food supply and management. I don't want this discussion to focus entirely on genetic farming. That happens to be the last point that I've raised in my book because it is controversial. But I just want to state very strongly that I believe through genetic modifications in some crops, We can reduce the amount of fertilizer we're using on crops. We can reduce the amount of pesticides. We can reduce the amount of herbicides. We can reduce the amount of water required. We can even reduce the amount of land that's used to produce the same amount of food. Now, some of those objectives have already been achieved. Obviously, we need to test the impact of such crops on human health. That's another purpose of science, to make sure that these judgments are made on scientific grounds, not on the basis of distortion and myth. But I have a number of other urgent steps that I've proposed that come ahead of genetically modified crops, and I hope we can talk about some of those steps.
Spell them out.
Number one, I want the United Nations to commit itself right now to providing a good, nutritious school lunch for every school child in the world who is not now receiving one. There are about 300 million such children, largely in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, who trudge off to school in the morning. They sit through 6 hours of instructions without a bite to eat. I'm a former teacher. I know that you can't carry on education on those grounds. Of those 300 million school-age kids, 130 million don't go to school at all, most of them girls, because of the favoritism that's shown towards boys. They're condemned to lives of illiteracy. Now, what happens when we start a school lunch in an area like that? Number one, school attendance skyrockets. Parents make sure that both girls and boys get to school if there's a nutritious meal being offered. Academic performance goes up, athletic performance, general health. And an interesting thing happens with the girls. Illiterate girls, by tests that we've actually conducted, have an average of six children for each girl. They get married when they're 12, 13, 14 years of age, and they have six children for each illiterate girl. Once they're in school, and a school lunch will pull them into school, girls marry later in life. They have an average of 2.9 children. This is an idea whose time has come. It may take us several years to reach this many school children, but it's something we can do and that we ought to do.
Okay, school lunches around the world as an empowerment device, as an educational device, indirectly, in effect, a birth control device. What's next?
The WIC program, which we have in the United States, is one of the best pieces of federal legislation ever put on the statute books. It came into being in the 1970s. It provides nutritious food for pregnant, needy women and needy nursing women and their infants through the age of five. We ought to extend that program. When I say we, I mean the United Nations, with the United States in the lead, to all the vulnerable women and children. This would give us a companion piece to the school lunch program. It's one of the best things we could do. I have no doubt that if we establish those two programs, we can literally transform life on this planet.
Peter Rossett, I wonder how you react to, I mean, these two sort of main strokes to do for the world what American farm policy has done in this country.
Well, I think that school lunch programs and women and infant programs are very important, and certainly those are things that were created in a very opportune moment in our own country. Unfortunately, they've been cut back of late, and certainly other countries would do very well, and the United Nations would do very well to promote those kinds of programs. I would just insert one caveat, and that's that the most effective way to have school lunch programs and women and infant programs interact in a way that promotes local food producing capacity is that the food for those programs, whenever possible, should be bought from local farmers. That strengthens local food production and distribution networks in recipient countries and in poor areas and leads towards greater food security in the future. So I think it's a wonderful idea, and I would just want to put in that particular 2 cents as far as the way in which such programs would be set up.
I agree with that 100%. I have that proviso in my book, as you probably know, Chris, that wherever possible, such food should be purchased from local farmers. We even authorize in the legislation that former Senator Dole and I are proposing for the consideration of Congress that some of the surplus commodities that might be donated from this and other countries could be sold, and the currency used to buy local commodities from farmers in these countries where food programs would be operating.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Food and Farm and the Hunger connection with Senator George McGovern. Marguerite is on the line.
Hi, Senator McGovern. What a thrill to talk to you. I campaigned for you so hopefully in 72, and the tragedy of our country is that we cannot elect to a high office men like you who are so honest and compassionate.
Well, Massachusetts did its best to bring that about, and I'll never forget it.
Marguerite, I was just thinking, I mean, did Richard Nixon ever get calls like yours? Go ahead.
I don't think so. The terrible thing today is that all the American farmers are so hard-pressed to sustain themselves that they're, as you know, going out of business totally, and they're lost. It just happens that 3 weeks ago, young cousins of mine, in third generation on a farm, a dairy farm in New York State, had to sell off all of their cows, and now the two young men in their 40s are lost, not knowing what to do with their lives. They're getting some jobs that are terrible. They're so used to farming. But it was impossible to keep going simply because they had bad weather, so they couldn't produce all the food for their cows. And the living is so hard for them to support their families and struggle and buy them, you know, very expensive machinery they need and still keep going. So now they've lost the farm, and it's out of the family's hand now, and they're lost. But what should be done to help them? As I think in France and other countries in Europe, they help their farmers more.
Yes, they do indeed. I have always believed throughout my public career that we need some kind of a price support mechanism for American family-type farms, a mechanism under which the government would agree to guarantee a price floor, in return for which farmers would have to gear their production to what the market would absorb at a reasonable price. As I said earlier on this program, I think that ought to be limited to family-type farms. The big corporate-sized farms don't need that kind of price subsidy help. But this kind of program does operate with European countries, and it's something we ought to consider establishing in this country. Now, I would add that the program that I've just described here, under which the U.S. and other countries belonging to the United Nations would establish school feeding and preschool feeding programs, indirectly that would help American farmers. We persuaded former President Clinton to support this idea, and he ordered the first $300 million in farm surplus from this country made available to the World Food Program in Rome and to private voluntary agencies such as Catholic Relief Services and CARE and other programs of that kind. That will take some of the pressure off farm markets here. It's not a major answer, but it's a helpful partial answer.
Marguerite, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Hunger connection. Catherine is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for having me. I have a quick question for you, Senator, and just a grateful opportunity to ask this. I work with the Greater Boston Food Bank, and we're part of the national system, the largest domestic hunger relief organization, America's Second Harvest. 26 million Americans use our system. All of the things that you already know. So my quick question to you is, when looking at the U.S., clearly the emergency food system has moved to an ongoing maintenance system. It's no longer crisis in the United States. It's about people not able to sustain themselves. Our public policies have not addressed poverty and therefore not addressed hunger. So my question is, what are your thoughts in building a more sustainable system to end hunger in the U.S.? And inclusive of that, is that influence in farm policy or nutrition policy, or do you think it'll ever change?
Yes, I think it has to change. Let me preface my remarks by saying that I was honored by America's Second Harvest, your organization, at your last annual meeting. In fact, I was given an award by the organization. America's Second Harvest is one of the great organizations in this country. I suppose a modest increase in the minimum wage would do as much as anything to relieve poverty and to relieve hunger in the United States. We don't have the kind of raw starvation in this country that you see in Africa and other parts of the globe, but we do have more than 30 million Americans who are hungry. They run out of food stamps with a week or 10 days still to go in the month. So I would like to see the food stamp program restored to where it was before cuts were made in the 1980s. Maybe a combination of a modest increase in food stamp coverage and, secondly, a modest increase in minimum wages would resolve the problem for these 30 million hungry Americans.
Peter Rossett, how does that sound to you?
Well,
you said, and it's the first I've heard it, I think, that hunger has has grown since the Clinton welfare measures took effect.
Well, that's right. And I think that, as the senator pointed out, cutbacks in, on the one hand, assistance programs like food stamps, and on the other hand, the fact that the minimum wage in this country has lagged way beyond inflation now for about 30 years, putting poor people now below 1960 average incomes in terms of real purchasing power, go a long way towards explaining why we have the paradox of plenty, which is what hunger is. Hunger is growing amidst economic boom. Of course, now we're moving into a recession, so that can't augur very well for hungry people. I also think we have to ask larger questions about our goals as a society, and I'm sure the senator would agree with that. We have to take back these kinds of issues, put them back at the center of political consciousness in America. We have to ask questions like, is it right that 36 million Americans go hungry in the wealthiest country in the world? Our recent book, America Needs Human Rights, basically makes that argument.
Peter Rossett, we'll come back to it. We're talking about food production and farms and hunger with former Senator George McGovern. His book is called The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking with the former Senator George McGovern about hunger in the world. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. In the book, The Third Freedom, Senator McGovern, you speak every other page about your friend Bob Dole. You were sort of farm state neighbors and allies on virtually all of these policies. Could he explain them to President Bush, do you think?
Well, let me say this. I have no knowledge at this point as to what the new administration will do with these proposals. I do know that they were enthusiastically embraced by former President Clinton and by the Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, and Madeleine Albright and the whole team. But I think it's the kind of proposal that President Bush and Secretary of State General Powell could very well support.
By the way, let me just
ask. There's a certain conservative aspect about what we're proposing here, which is to save human life, to improve human health, to improve education, to help girls live a more satisfying type of life. I think that will have appeal to conservatives as well as liberals.
But let me ask you, you're a political animal. You look at that map of this country that, with an asterisk, elected President Bush. All of those farm states, all of those wheat states are colored in red. Republican.
Right.
How did the Democrats manage with farmer-friendly policies like yours to alienate the farms?
Well, I don't know whether it's right to say we alienated them, and no one really knows yet just how the farm vote broke down. You know, everyone, even in my state of South Dakota, is not a farmer. Probably a fourth of the people in that state live on farms at the most, but we have cities in South Dakota. They're not as big as Boston, but we do have
cities. They listen
cities
to the connection out there.
And we listen to the connection. So that it's difficult to know about what motivates people to vote. I never have fully understood how I got elected in South Dakota all those years. I was the first Democrat in a quarter of a century to be elected to high office in South Dakota, and I stayed in office a long time. But I really believe this is a program that ought to have broad bipartisan appeal. I'm talking now about the children's aspect about it. Maybe not everything that I've proposed in this book is going to be that appealing. But the thing that appeals to former Senator Dole is the idea of providing a decent meal once a day for every poor kid in the world. Senator Dole is obviously a conservative Republican, but he's also a man with a heart, and he and I worked together in the Senate on everything that had anything to do with food and agriculture, and I'm glad that he's backing this universal child feeding program now. We're going to go in and try to talk to the new administration about getting behind this, and I'm optimistic that we will succeed.
1-800-423-8255 makes the George McGovern connection. Ian is calling from Potsdam, New York.
Hi.
Hello, Ian.
In the 20s, during the Depression, all the farms were collapsing due to the Dust Bowl situation. They found an aquifer deep, spanning from Nebraska down to Texas, and we've been using this aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, for water since then. But it's going to run out in about 50 years, and then it's going to be a Dust Bowl situation again. I was wondering what Senator McGovern might have thought about the situation.
Well, a number of things have been done to try to offset the Dust Bowl days again. Number one, beginning in the 1930s, shelter belts of trees were planted all across the Great Plains. They were scoffed at first, but they have literally transformed life in our part of the country. Trees tend to break up Dust Bowl situations. They break up the winds that used to sweep across the prairies. We've also engaged in better farming methods. We don't plow some of the grasslands that used to be plowed. We let them lie in grass. Those areas have been taken up by ranches rather than intensive farming, and that's helpful. We've also built small check embankments and small check dams and other things to hold water for use in lean times. I'm not saying we're entirely free of the danger of dust that we saw out there when I was growing up in South Dakota, but I think we've greatly reduced the danger.
Ian, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the George McGovern connection. Don is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes.
Hello, Don.
A pleasure to talk with you. I agree with absolutely everything that everyone has said, especially the education of women as a population-reducing factor. But the fact still remains the World Bank, the UN, Population Reference Bureau, all project a doubling time of the population of the less developed world of about 40 years. And it would seem that a prudent policy in trying to deal with hunger would also be to deal with a population problem. And that's particularly, I think, salient today since the Bush administration reimposed the prohibition of the use of U.S. funds for birth control for nations that use abortion as one of the methods, and that's a reimposition of something that the Reagan administration does. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, first, let me come back to one of the points I make in the book, and that is this, that while population growth is increasing, it has been slowed considerably. As a matter of fact, food production is increasing at a rate about 16% faster than population growth. I remember back in the 1960s, the gloomy predictions about population outstripping our capacity to feed people. Just the reverse has happened. Partly through scientific farming and the slowing of the population curve, we can say truthfully that we're in better shape today to deal with the population of the world than we were 40 years ago. And we should be in still better shape 40 years down the road. The best figures available to us on what the population of the globe will look like 50 years from now is that it'll level off at around 10 billion people, from 6 billion today to 10 billion 50 years from now. Then it's expected there'll be a kind of a leveling off of the population rate, particularly if we can carry out the education of girls and young women. I read a statement the other day by the former Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Lawrence Summers. He's a tough-minded guy. He didn't get to be Secretary of the Treasury with loose thinking. And he said when he was a senior official with the World Bank that dollar for dollar, the greatest return we will get on overseas assistance is in the education of girls. I think that's so important. You just can't stress that too much. And that's where we ought to make a priority drive. And if anybody can come up with a better idea than school lunches to pull these illiterate girls into school, I would like to know what it is. I think it's the best magnet there is to get these illiterate girls into school where they get some education.
1-800-423-TALK makes the Senator George McGovern connection. Mark is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I've been volunteering with a group called Food Now Bombs in Boston here for the last 10 years, feeding folks on the streets. And basically, we feed people food that would otherwise be thrown away. And through this work, I became aware that the first world probably throws away enough food every day to feed the third world. And it's just a matter of distribution and prioritization rather than any sort of growing techniques. Mr. McGovern pointed out that biotech, I understand that's not the main thrust of his argument, but biotech reduces the use of pesticides and herbicides. But I believe that's wrong. My understanding is that in the case of Monsanto's Roundup Ready, it actually makes the crop able to tolerate a higher dosage of pesticides and herbicides, therefore increasing the need for those chemicals.
Mark, I take your point, and I think Senator McGovern has dealt with the chemical question, whether you agree with him or not. Is there more to say on that?
Well, just to say that chemical fertilizer is not genetically modified crops, and one of the reasons for genetically modified crops is to reduce the dependence on chemical fertilizers or any kind of fertilizer. Someone on the program here that called in mentioned that organic foods is the answer. Well, organic foods are fine insofar as they go, but we're now getting warnings that the natural fertilizer that's used on some organic foods is working its way into the food in a way that's not healthy for us. Just saying that food is natural doesn't mean that it's healthy. Rat poison is natural, but it's not very healthy for us.
1-800-423-8255. Join the conversation with Senator George McGovern. Anne is calling from Kenoka, South Dakota.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Anne, very good.
Good. I had a couple comments, and one thing I wanted to say was that I think I can provide a little insight into why it is that you talk about the big swath of red through the middle of the country.
Yes.
Looking back to one of the debates between Al Gore and George Bush, They asked, one person asked about agricultural policy, and George Bush talked about value-added agriculture and items like that, which are big buzzwords. And Al Gore, as I recall, talked just about basically going back to the programs where the government regulated supply and tried to prop up the prices with price supports. You know, we tried that for over 40 years since the programs that FDR put into place, and we've discovered that they don't work. And so we have to do something. And one of the things I found somewhat ironic listening to the senator today was when he was talking about buying, starting, for example, a worldwide WIC program where they buy products locally and encourage the local people to be local farmers for local consumption, which I think is a wonderful idea, but it's diametrically opposed to the policies in the United States. For example, here you would not be able to do that with our programs because they're just not they're not set up that way.
Are you talking state by state or American produce in general, Anne?
American products in general. You know, there was a famous, I can't tell you the name because it escapes me at the moment, but there's a famous case back in the FDR days where they had a farmer in the Midwest who was trying to grow a few acres of grain for consumption by himself and his family, which, you know, is the kind of local production we're talking about encouraging worldwide now, right? The federal government took him to court and stopped it.
And the question for George McGovern is, can you do better for the third world than American policy does for Kanoka?
Well, I think you got the city wrong. It must be Kadoka that we're talking about here, either Kadoka or Kanova. I'm not sure which, but there's no Kanoka in South Dakota. Anyway, let me just say this. When I say we would buy some products, the United Nations would buy some products for local producers, that's the only way you could get this program accepted in most countries. But still, there would be a large market for American farm produce in supplying things that couldn't be supplied by these local producers.
George McGovern, I got to wrap us up and get us out of here, but thank you for joining us and thank you for a noble project. The book is The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. Thanks also to Peter Rossett of Food First. George McGovern will be reading at Wordsworth Bookstore in Cambridge this evening, Wednesday at 6 p.m., and you can continue the hunger conversation on our website, Connection Listeners, at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation. This is